This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I have here today in the studio a special guest, Carol J. Perry, and she's here, and we're going to be talking about her adventures at Sleuth Fest, and also about some of her books. At the bottom of the hour, stay tuned, because I have Hector McDonald. He's coming on, and he's going to be calling in from all the way from England to talk about his new book called Truth, How the Many Sides of Every Story Shape Our Reality. So I'm going to be looking forward to that. But meanwhile, I'm very happy that Carol's in the studio with me, because I have a cold, and I'm going to let her do most of the talking. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Patsy.
Okay.
I think you invited me because you know I can talk about books for hours and hours.
Well, that's it, so I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to talk, maybe not for the next 30 minutes, okay? Just tell us about your adventures at Sleuth Fest. Tell us, everybody, what it is.
Sleuth Fest is a large writer's conference that's held every year, and it's sponsored by the Florida chapter of the Mystery Writers of America. And this was my second adventure at Sleuth Fest, although they've been going for many years, 20-odd years. They always have very special keynote speakers and lots of really heavy hitters in the agent business, in the editor business, and writers, of course. The keynote speaker this time was Andrew Gross, who some people know him as one of the writers for, I have my little cheat sheet out here. He's a New York writer, and he is known sometimes because he collaborated with James Patterson, who of course uses many writers to, because nobody could be as prolific as that. What is it, a book a month? I'm not sure.
I think so.
But Andrew was very articulate. He had just was a couple of weeks away from having a pacemaker implanted, but he was brave enough to come and fulfill his obligation here, and he was quite inspiring. Part of the reason he was so inspiring was so many of the writers, not only there, but every conference you ever see, have had numerous rejections. And Andrew, his family, women of a certain age will remember this, because his family ran the Leslie K Company, which was a women's sportswear company. I, being of a certain age, do remember Leslie Faye. I was an ad manager for an old New England department store, and we carried the brand. And he grew up there and attended the Barnett School for Boys, and his father and his grandfather both were successful clothing manufacturers, so he fell into that line of business. And he worked there, and he was a dress buyer, and he opened a fast food place. He just had many different occupations as time went by. But then he took over at Head Sportswear, the ski and tennis people, and they were really, really in bad trouble. And he managed to pull them up to a number one brand, and he was very proud of that. And he did very well, and he and his wife, who had a few kids, and they had the house in Westchester, and the kids were in private school and all that good stuff. And he went to a writer's program at the University of Iowa, and started to draft his first book, which was called, I have to look at my notes, Hydra. And he submitted it here and there, and he finally got an agent. And the agent said, no, this is going to do well, and I'm going to send it to so many publishers that they'll be bidding on this. It's so good. So on the strength of that, he continued to live his usual lifestyle. And although the agent submitted it to 24 publishers, poor Andrew was in receipt of 24 rejections. All of them rejected it. And what am I going to do? And then one day, as he was sitting there being sad, he got a phone call from someone he didn't know who said, "Can you take a call from James Patterson?" Yes. Wait a minute.
I think so.
Wait a minute. I'll think that over for a minute. Well, it turned out that one of the publishers who had seen and rejected the book also knew or had worked with Patterson. And Patterson was working on a thing called the Women's Murder Club series. And she, this publisher, told Andrew Gross that she had made a note on his manuscript and sent it to James Patterson. It said, let's see if I can say it right, "This guy does women well." Huh. So this brought cheers from the audience.
guys like to hear that.
So Patterson said that, you know, he needs some to do that. So it became a collaboration. And he worked with him on several books, Second Chance and Third Degree. Both went to number one on New York Times bestseller list. And then they co-authored a few that were not in that series. And it was more bestsellers, The Jester, Lifeguard, and Judge and Jury. So by this time, he had had a number of books on the New York Times bestseller list without his name on them. So he decided to perhaps strike out on his own. And although he speaks kindly of Patterson, he doesn't like being known as one of the Patterson writers because he's a pretty damn good writer on his own. So he struck out and does his own. But at the end, he did the keynote speech. It was, you know, the hall was completely silent. And he said, now he's had several bestsellers, although not number one, of his own. But he said, "And you know what? The proudest moment, really, in my life so far was when I brought that sportswear company up to number one from a failing company." Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And what he signed books very graciously, and the Murder on the Beach bookstore from Delray Beach was in charge of the bookshop there. What, isn't that a great name?
Don't you wish
you had a bookstore named Murder on the Beach?
And
you were in Delray Beach. And they're just wonderful staff of people there, too. And they carried my books, which is very nice. I did not sign as many as Andrew Gross did. Now, in addition to the keynote, am I babbling on too much? Is this good? Okay. I went to, because I was moderating a panel for the first time, and the people on my panel were just great. They were so professional, and they just made it easy. Sharon Potts, who writes really good mysteries, I had not read her before, but I went to the library and got one of her books quickly. Con Lehane, who writes the 49th Street Library books. If you don't have it yet, I'll bring you one. And he also writes a series of books about a Brian McNulty bartender series. And he admits that he spent more time in bars than he did in libraries.
That's a nice research.
Yeah, and he's a professor, and he's very well read and very well informed. It's just charming. And Chris Jackson, who writes pretty much nonfiction, although she is starting to write mysteries, and she has a book about Edgar Allan Poe, which is titled "The Telltale Art." Wasn't she smart to do that? Yeah, and very analytical, but readable to just an ordinary person. So they were great, but I wanted to see how panels were conducted by others before I did it. And first I went to a panel of agents who were very explicit about what they were looking for. And it was interesting because they were, it was so varied. Let's see if I've got information on them. There was a woman called Jenny Bent. Jenny was looked to be the youngest, because young people start to look about 12, you know, go to these things. But Jenny has her own agency. It's the Bent Agency. And she has several New York Times best-selling authors: A.G. Howard, Lindsay Sands, some I can't pronounce, Governor John Kasich, Goldie Moldavsky, and a couple of Edgar Award winners. And she represents most areas of crime and suspense, including young adult, but is not looking for cozy mysteries. Very explicitly does not like cozy mysteries, which is what I write, you know.
Yes.
Then Annie Bomke has her own literary agency, and she loves books. You could tell from her enthusiasm. And at lunch, because lunch is provided at these events, and they're all round tables, and each table has one of the celebrity speakers, the agents or the editors or somebody that you might like to talk to at lunch. And she was at that, and she was very good in sharing and does cover all kinds of mystery genre and YA fiction. And she likes magical realism. Not everybody likes the magical books, but a number of people still write them. Evan Marshall, he's worked for Houghton Mifflin and Dodd Mead, and he was very professional. And let me see, there's another guy. And each one just was so explicit about what they wanted, and really worth going to their websites, because every agent has one. And it just wasted your time, writers, if you send to the wrong agents. Look them up.
Absolutely. You must do your research.
Because in the first place, they're not going to look at your work. In the second place, you've ticked them off. So,
exactly.
And they're not going to hand it off to anyone else. Mitchell, I know there were similar names, Mitchell Walters, and he was very... very good. And I have to brag about a fellow writer who goes to Pinellas Writers every Saturday, which meets at Largo Rec. And Sally Palmer is writing a mystery. She's on her second one in a series. And it's just wonderful. Everybody, you know, loves it at the meetings. But then you say, well, what about professionals? Well, you have the opportunity to do a pitch to an agent. And she pitched to two. One of them said, send me the manuscript right now. Didn't even ask for just sample chapters. Well. And the other one asked for it. Then on Sunday morning, they had what they called a pitch tank. And this is where all of the agents are lined up, and everybody that wants to pitch is lined up together in a room, and you just pitch. And she said she was surprised there were only six there, but two more asked for her manuscript. So she is thrilled, and this is a local writer that I bet will be a joy on paper before too long, because it is so good. So she writes funny, and funny in a cozy is a good thing.
Oh, I love funny in a cozy.
Yeah, she's so good at it. Wonderful character names, and I won't spoil it by telling you anymore, but you're going to love it. I know you will. Then I went to the editor's panel, which... they weren't quite so giving and friendly as the agents were, but it may have been that the moderator didn't ask the right questions. I'm not sure. But the editors also were kind of specific about what they were looking for. And I found that that's another thing. When you are looking just for a publisher who accepts unagented work, and there are a number of them who do. In fact, there was one here that said he did. Oh, here's a Florida one I want to tell you about. But anyway... go to the publisher's page, and even if it doesn't have a list of editors right at the top of the page, just put editors at blah, blah, publishing, and you will get the list of editors and what they want. And that's how I got my wonderful editor at Kensington.
Now, these are editors who are looking for materials.
Yes.
So you can go straight to them without having an agent.
Some places. Now, if you look in Writer's Market... a lot of them now say agent and manuscripts only. This is, I think, partly because back long, long ago, when all we had was a Royal portable typewriter, and as you were working on your manuscript with your carbon paper, so you'd have a copy, because we didn't have a copier either, and if you changed a character's name or if you changed your plot, you had to retype the whole thing. So there weren't that many things coming over the transom in those days, because it was darn hard work. Did I ever tell you? one of the writers I worked with, named Lynn, came in just after Christmas one time, and she said, my cleaning lady came to me and said, I got a computer for Christmas, Lynn, and now I'm going to be a writer just like you. And Lynn said, writers just like me are a dime a dozen, but a good cleaning lady is hard to find. And I think this happened to the publishing business, and so many manuscripts are so easy, comparatively, to produce whether they're good or not is a judgment call, but they were so overwhelmed with too many manuscripts that it's better for them, many of them, the big ones, to have an agent pass through to be sure this is something I might possibly want to see. So I think that's the reason. Now, it happened that the editor I contacted at Kensington did accept unagented work. And there's one here. I was just looking at my beautiful, colorful handout from Sleuthfest. And this fellow is called Eric Campbell, and I'm going to read from his description. And the name of his publishing company is Down and Out Books. Have you ever heard of it?
No, but I like the name.
He's from Lutz.
Okay.
Eric Campbell is the founder and publisher of Down and Out Books, based in Lutz, Florida. After spending 25 years in healthcare finance, Eric started Down and Out Books as an avenue to help develop and build, in parentheses, lost authors. Since then, the company has published over 200 books and is home to several imprints, including All Due Respect, Shotgun Honey, and ABC Documentation. They specialize in crime, thriller, and suspense genres. Down and Out Books does accept unagented submissions. And a number of these agents that I listened to, I didn't talk to all of them, but I listened to them, a number of them also do submit to really, really top publishers. But some of the editors we talked to did accept unagented submissions. So you just have to look at the guidelines from those publishers. And it is so important that you do exactly what they say.
Oh.
If they say they want 10 pages, I mean, if it stops in the middle of a sentence, they
matter.
Want 10 pages.
And
they
can
tell by the first three whether you're any good or not anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they are really, well, it's like anything. I mean, we all have the way we see things. It's like when you're writing a letter, some people will use a certain font. Mm-hmm. And because that's what's easy on their eyes.
Yes.
And so that's why sort of in the script world, when you're writing a script, everything's supposed to be done, at least before, was always done in Courier because that's what their eyes were used to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put anything, you try Times, New Roman, anything, they wouldn't read it because their eyes were accustomed to that Courier.
Sure.
And they wanted to always have that font. Although I always found it very light. You know, it's a light font.
Yes, it is.
And I thought, I prefer a dark font, but that's what they want, so that's what you use. And and when you're writing a script, you don't go over 120 pages. I mean, not if you want it read, because when they get a script, they turn.
Yep.
They don't read the first page.
Right.
They turn to the back. And if it's over 120 pages, they'll just toss it.
Oh, they can be selective.
Oh yeah, they are.
Oh yeah.
Why not?
Sure.
So, you have to follow the rules, and all of them have it on their website, and you know, it's a funny thing. You know, I was talking to one author, and she said, in the old days when she used to submit and get rejections, mm-hmm. it was so nice because they would send a nice letterhead.
Yes.
You'd get a nice rejection.
Yep.
You know,
yep,
it would be on. Just it might.
And sometimes a handwritten note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and it'd be so nice. And she was so sad that she hadn't saved all of them. At the she didn't realize that computers were going to come along and there'd never be another typed and hand signed rejection letter, because those are now would be a nice thing to have, you know.
Actually, I did get some signed rejection letters from all those agents that rejected me.
Yeah. But I think those days are past too. Nowadays they want it submitted. Mostly, I mean, almost all of them want an email.
Yeah, they do.
And the body of the submission in the actual email, mm-hmm. they don't want to click on attachments because they're afraid.
Yeah.
They're afraid of getting...
A number of them said that.
Yeah.
And some didn't mind. And some said, I now one of them, Mitchell Waters, who's at Curtis Brown, said, I love to get them in mail. Huh? He said, I hardly get mail anymore. And he said, I like it if you send me your manuscript.
So he's from the old school.
He is from the old school. But
try it.
He likes it. He said, I hardly ever get mail. I love mail.
Yeah.
So.
Well, then that's an opportunity.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Always try to find out what they like, you know?
Yeah. And I've not at this conference, but I remember hearing an agent at another conference quite a long time ago, but he said, I know that I've turned down some good books. He said, especially science fiction, because I just don't get it. I don't like to read it. I just don't get it. Not that it's not good and not that a lot of people might buy it, but I don't accept it because I don't get it. Now, the silliest one I ever heard, this was when I was writing travel articles, was an editor, a magazine editor, who said, I never accept anything that's sent to me with coated paper clips. They're not recyclable. So she checks it into the trash with your coated paper clip article. Now, that's just dumb.
Well, it's like submitting a script. When you're submitting a script, you have to punch it, and you have to use two brads, not three. Although the punching might have three holes.
Yeah.
You can never put that center one in.
Isn't that funny?
If you put the center brad in, they'll throw it away. Same thing.
Isn't that funny? Now, the courier still, it usually says in guidelines, courier or Times New Roman, yeah. And they like 12, and some say they like 14. So, but whatever it says, do that. And if they only, are we going to run into a... Patsy and I are both sitting here with Kleenex.
Oh, okay, great. I have to cut this out. Okay, I don't know. Big Ed disappeared. We're going to do a commercial break in a minute.
No, he's running now. There we go. He's coming back.
Great, okay. We're going to do a commercial break.
Let's do it.
And
then we're going to talk about the arc of the novel.
Exactly. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome back to Joy on Paper. I have in the studio my very special guest, Carol J. Perry, whose most recent book is what?
It Takes a Coven.
Takes a Coven. And we're going to be talking to her in a minute. And I'm then waiting for Hector McDonald to call in. He's calling in from England, and I think he's going to call in about 10 minutes. So we're going to talk to him. But I did want to mention that, of course, Carol's been talking about Sleuth Fest, which took place in Boca Raton. And we are great pals here with Mystery Writer of America, which runs the Sleuth Fest all over the country. And do you realize nine grandmasters have been on my program?
No.
Nine, yes. It's been quite an amazing thing.
Isn't that wonderful?
Including, of course, Mary Higgins Clark and Margaret Maron.
Love
Larry
Margaret
Block.
Man.
Oh gosh, I've had so much luck with all of those, and I've got three. This year there are three new grandmasters, and their names are Jane Langton, William Link, and Peter Lovesey, and I'm hoping to have them on in the next few months.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I bet you will.
I think so.
I think so.
So that's exciting.
Mystery Writers of America is the world's oldest organization of professional writers, and it's worldwide, not just American. And
of course, the first one was Agatha Christie was the first grandmaster.
Yep. Yeah, and isn't that fitting? Isn't that wonderful?
Absolutely.
Cozy writer of them all.
Exactly.
Yeah, she is. It's to be a member, there are certain rules that have to be followed. You have to be published by their list of acceptable publishers. But there are also associate memberships for those who are just beginning, or those who have self-published, or those who are looking for agents. So there are various degrees of membership. And they
award the Edgar Prize.
They award the Edgar, yeah.
Which is a big deal.
Oh, it is a really big deal. It is a big deal. There were a number of Edgar winners
at the event. Yeah. And I think someday you're going to be an Edgar winner.
You think?
I think so.
Andrew Gross was.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
I think you're going to make it.
Thank you.
I've got my finger. Maybe by the next Halloween, because Halloween is always very significant here for Carol, because her series is called Witch City Mysteries.
Yes.
And she comes here every Halloween.
Yeah.
And one of these Halloweens, she's going to come here and say, "Ah, I got the Edgar.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Or the Agatha. Those wonderful things. I'm going to have to go to Malice, though. That Malice Domestic, which is in Maryland, I think, every year. And that seems to be where the nominations come from.
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm going to have to do that.
You're going to have to do that.
Yeah. These conferences are expensive. But each time, if you have to stay at the hotel.
Yeah.
Now, the next one is BoucherCon, which is going to be in St. Pete.
Aren't
and that's
we
the
lucky?
Biggest
yeah.
of all of the mystery writers.
It's right here in town.
And there'll be the real heavy hitters there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to be at the Benoit.
Yeah.
Which is lovely and wonderful. I'm looking forward to that. I will definitely
And you won't
there.
Have to pay for the...
And I won't have to pay for the hotel.
Because it's expensive.
Yeah, it is. And a lot... I was surprised at the number of people at Sleuthfest who were not Florida writers that had come from far away. I spoke to J.E. Eaton. One of her books is also in that. And I think she's a husband-wife writer team, because it's both of their initials. And I did meet them. And... Their book is also on display at Barnes & Noble, and in a brief moment of selfish and self-promotion.
Well, I had the husband and wife team, the grandmasters, both of them were grandmasters.
Yeah, oh.
Marcia Muller and her husband, Bill Pronzini.
I did not know
yes,
that.
Yes, and
yeah.
They write books separately, but they also write books together. And I was so happy to have them on.
Oh.
And first she got it, and then he got it. And I think it was nice that she got it first.
Yeah, well, sure. Ladies first.
Exactly. And they were delightful.
Oh,
and, they write delightful books. So, yeah, it's...
My to-be-read pile. Partly because, like, I want to read Nancy Peacock's book, because I heard your interview with her.
Oh, yeah.
It sounded fascinating. She sounded delightful. I've already sent for Hart, John Hart. Is it Hart?
John Hart.
John Hart, yeah. I've already sent for his book.
Oh, The Hush.
The Hush. I want to say Rush. Hush. Yeah. And
because it was, well, in my article about him in my blog, I said Rush to the Hush.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah,
why I had
yeah. That's probably why it's transposed in my head. There are so many I want to read. Some by writers I know. Some who I should be reviewing and saying kind things about them. And I can't imagine you are to be red pile.
Oh, mine.
It must be awesome.
Oh, it is. It is really awesome. It is great. Yeah. Now, while I'm thinking about books, and for anyone who has a lot of books, contact Operation Paperback. This is a wonderful organization for military families where you can send your books. And it's called Operation what did I just say?
Paperback.
Operation Paperback. Yes, I would. And it's a wonderful thing. They give you a list of, like, the family, the ages of the kids or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can put together a box of books specifically for a family.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Because I get a lot of books. I get such a nice range of books. I get, you know, I get romances, I get thrillers, I get, you know, kids' books, I get young adult. And Operation Paperback is just a wonderful, wonderful organization for you to send your extra books, because these go to military families all over the country, and they really appreciate it. They really do.
Oh, I love knowing that. I'm going to tell my friends at Pinellas Writers on Saturday that they could do this, and I will look up. I guess they must have a website.
Yeah, know, oh, they have a print out operationpaperback.org. And they are just wonderful people, and it is such a joy to know that, you know, they love books, and for many of the families, particularly the, you know, the ones left behind here, and with the kids, they really appreciate it.
Oh, I bet they. Oh, that's good. Thank you for sharing that. That's a good thing to know.
It is. So, let's just talk for a minute about your latest release, because it's great. I know it because my sister.
Natalie is one of my number one fans.
Yes, my sister is really your number one fan. And so the minute, you know, you have a book out, she needs to read it. So let's talk about the newest one.
All right, the newest one is It Takes a Coven. Now, I have a number of reoccurring characters, and every once in a while, was one of the reviewers or one of the people on Goodreads or Amazon or, you know, the comment about the books would say, well, there wasn't enough about the cat in this one. There wasn't enough about Aunt Ivy in this one. So recently there was something that said there wasn't enough about River North. So River North is a witch and a tarot reader, and she is my protagonist Lee's best friend and a sidekick. So you always have to have one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought, well, this one is going to be River's book. And River has a very pronounced part in this. River has received from Lee a few books back a secret notebook that was written in the 1600s by Bridget Bishop, who was the first witch hanged in Salem.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot... An attorney told me that the Salem witch trials records are some of the most complete ever. They wrote down everything that was said in those trials. Well, Bridget Bishop did some kind of witchy stuff, and she apparently had the ability to turn herself into a crow or a pig or a cat.
Uh-huh.
Now, cats figure very prominently in all of my books. You'll know by the cover with my beautiful yellow cat on it. So River has been reading this book, which she never was going to do, but she's been saying some of these things aloud. And suddenly, several witches die. Some, one maybe by natural causes, and one fell out of his apple tree, and one got hit by a bike, and but they're dying. And also... this great accumulation. Salem's skies are black with crows who are roosting in trees and pooping on everything, and just a big nuisance in the town. And River thinks she may be responsible for the witch deaths and the...
and the crows.
The crows. And, of course, the collective noun for that, a number of crows, is a murder of crows.
Yeah, isn't that lovely?
Which would have been a lovely title if so many other people
everybody
used it.
I think there must be at least 10 murder crows.
Oh, yeah. So I couldn't use that, although I did refer to it as that in the book. So River, this is River's book, and how Lee and her detective boyfriend Pete and Aunt Ivy and, of course, the cat, and a remarkable crow, talking crow, named Poe, appropriately enough, help to solve the mystery. And they do.
So have you ever watched a video of that crow talking on YouTube?
Yes, I have seen that. It's written P-I-E-D, crow, and it's the only kind you can have as a pet. Because I have to research all these books. I have to know more than anyone ever did.
I didn't know crows could talk. It was and funny. Recently, I don't know
there was one at
what
the,
I was doing, and I discovered
At the Suncoast Bird Sanctuary, there's one that talks.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
He will talk to you.
Yeah. He says, what's your name?
Yeah.
Because people have said it to him so much.
Yeah.
So it's pronounced PID. But it's spelled P-I-E-D, and there is one of those. It's like the crows in the Windex commercial. Those are pied crows. They have little white spots on them.
I always thought, when I used to read that, I thought they were pied crows.
Yeah,
I thought people were making pies out of the crows.
Oh, please,
well,
no.
Yeah, no, when I, so when I was a kid.
420 blackbirds baked in a pie?
Well, yeah, I thought it was. Yeah. I thought that's what it was.
Nope. It's pronounced pit. I don't know why. Probably in whatever language it came from. But, yeah, I know more about crows than I ever wanted to.
Okay.
Big Ed is on the phone. That looks important.
Yeah, Big Ed is on the phone.
Yes, he is.
And I think we're just waiting now for, I don't know, they are getting Hector on the line.
I know. Transatlantic calls.
Hi.
Oh, my dear.
Hi. Hi, this is Patsy. Are you there, Hector?
Patsy. Hello, it's Hector. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, I'm so happy to talk to you.
I love the name of your show, Joy on Paper, is that right?
Yes, because I think just writing things down and getting it on paper gives you a lot of joy, and so that's why I named it Joy on Paper.
Fantastic. Well, I feel that way, and I think reading stuff on paper is pretty joyous as well.
It is. And reading your book, I'm not sure I'd use the word joyous, but it's funny in many places. And we have to talk about it. It's called Truth, How the Many Sides of Every Story Shape Our Reality. By the way, where are you in England?
I'm in London, so it's pretty cold and wet here. I don't know about you, but it's I'm happy to be talking to a different place where hopefully
Oh, it's beautiful, yes. Well, we're in glorious Clearwater, Florida. It's always gorgeous here. But I lived in England for many years. I lived in Sonning. You know, just outside
of... Not too far away. Yeah. Beautiful place.
Oh, it is. Lovely. I bought, when I was 21 years old, I bought this old English cottage that was 400 years old. And so it was quite an adventure.
That must have been fun. No 21-year-old can afford to buy an English cottage these days.
Oh, no.
Priced out of the market.
At that time, it was £19,000 at that time. So, yes, you couldn't touch anything in Sonning for £19,000 today.
I'm afraid not. Not. No.
Well, to tell you the truth, this is an interesting book because I was thinking, when we're looking at things nowadays, when we're looking at television or we're reading things or any, I don't trust anything anymore. So I thought, boy, this book came along at just the right time.
Well, I think that's true, and we all are feeling this sense of cynicism and weariness around the world as we feel that, you know, more and more politicians are lying to us, more and more, you know, marketers or businesses or campaigners are trying to mislead us. And so what I wanted to do in this was not so much look at the lies and the outright falsehoods, because I think we see that, we recognize those when they happen, you know, the lies about inauguration crowd sizes or whatever it may be, or what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. Those are clear lies, But we can also look at elements of the truth which politicians and other communicators use in ways that are not entirely honest. And that's what really interested me, is how people use, for example, statistics or unusual definitions of words or unusual interpretations of events and, you know, scripture and predictions about the future in ways that are very influential. They convince us to act, they convince us to do things, to buy things, to vote for people, to go to war, to die for our country, whatever it may be, and yet they're not entirely representative of reality.
Well, what I hate that term, true facts. They're using it like on the news, they say, oh, this is a true fact. And then, I mean...
As opposed to the other kind.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have to go to Cambridge or Oxford to understand Latin and know where you know, I mean, really, it's so annoying. And as you said, we're being manipulated in so many ways.
So what I've tried to do is start to set out, in a structured format, some of those ways that we get manipulated and some of the ways in which the truth can be used to mislead us, to give people a little bit more experience with it, a bit more of a sort of structured awareness, and so that people can start to recognize when this is happening and perhaps use some of the tools I offer in the book to neutralize those misleading truths and resist passing them on to their friends as if, you know, and just becoming another link in the misleader's chain.
Well, it's funny. I got the book about I think about a month ago, and I was reading the book, and then shortly after that, I went. I was invited out to dinner to this fancy restaurant, and there was on the menu. You tell us about this Wagyu beef thing, because it was so funny.
Oh, Wagyu, that one, yes.
I love that.
I was using that just as an example of how we can be misled in thinking about prices. It's a chapter on financial value, how we value things. And, of course, you might, if I ask you what is the value of a certain product, you might look at its price tag and say, well, that's the value is the price. But, of course, that's not true. We value things objectively. We each have a different sense of the value of a dish on a menu and so on. But our valuation can be easily misled or manipulated by the restaurant, by the marketers, by, for example, using what's called a price anchor. And this is where a restaurant will put a very, very expensive item on a menu, like, for example, a Wagyu beef steak at $100. To make you feel that everything else on that menu is really very cheap, because look at those shrimp there; they're just $40, so that's a real bargain. And because the beef is there, you think that's a great deal. But of course, if the beef wasn't there, you'd go, $40 for a plate of shrimp. Is that really what I want to spend my $40 on? So we get easily influenced by these clever pricing tricks that marketers and businesses can use.
And television commercials. Oh my gosh, I'm going crazy. I shouldn't say this, but I actually don't watch much television, live television, because I tape everything and I go through. I can't look at some of these commercials anymore.
That's right. Well, there's a lot of very interesting misleading truths in commercials. One of the ones I pull out in the book, because it was banned in the UK by the Advertising Standards Authority, so I have a good legal footing for this one, is the Colgate toothpaste claim, which I'm not sure if you had in the States, but we've had it for many years.
Oh, yes. 80%.
80% of dentists, more than 80% of dentists recommend Colgate toothpaste. And this was a very powerful claim. I was very influenced by it. I still buy Colgate most of the time, probably because of it.
So do I.
But what that claim was based on was a survey not asking dentists which toothpaste they recommended, but which toothpaste, plural, might they recommend. In other words, name all the brands that you might consider recommending. And, of course, most dentists recommended several brands. They named several brands, including Colgate. So the advertising gave us the impression that these dentists they surveyed almost entirely preferred Colgate, but that wasn't the case at all. It was just one of the brands that they would be willing to recommend amongst many others.
But it was very effective. I think for 20 years I only bought Colgate.
it was very effective, and of course it was true. The statement was true, and yet, despite the fact it was true, it was banned by our regulator in the UK because it was so misleading.
So, when you were now, you didn't do as much sort of on site kind of research for this. You studied facts and numbers and stories to come out with all of these. Some of these stories are really really fun to read. So, tell us what are your favorite stories in here.
Well, I came at this from a whole range of interests. So I'm, by training, I'm a scientist with a lot of statistical training. So obviously there's a chapter on numbers in here, looking at how statistics can be messed with and, how you can make numbers look bigger or smaller using various clever tricks. But I'm also, fascinated by history. So there's a chapter on how we omit elements of our history or selectively focus on elements of our history in order to, advance a modern day agenda. There's a couple of fascinating examples in that. For example, the Texas Board of Education, I think it is, the State Board of Education in 2015 decided to omit, to leave out most of the discussion of slavery from their history books and of course declared that the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War, was fought almost entirely based on states' rights rather than the issue of slavery, which they considered a side issue. So that's the kind of reshaping of history, which I think a lot of people would feel was unreasonable, even though to leave something out is not necessarily to lie. It's just to omit the truth. Other elements of the story of the book that I really enjoyed, the context chapter, I think is fascinating. How you can take a true statement and completely change its meaning by changing the words you put around that statement, by changing the introduction to that statement. And there's a beautiful example of this in the book, which is a UK example, but one I'm sure that your listeners will be familiar with, which is 10 Downing Street, the home of our Prime Minister. And a little experiment was done with a black and white cat named Humphrey that used to live at that address. And surveyors showed a picture of Humphrey to British voters and asked them to say whether or not they liked the look of this cat. With some of those voters, they named the cat Margaret Thatcher's cat, you know, famous right-wing prime minister. And they found that left-wing voters really didn't like the cat when it was named that. But then they named it Tony Blair's cat because this cat has lived there throughout both those prime ministerships. And they found, bizarrely, that the left-wing voters really did like the cat when it was named Tony Blair's cat. So same cat, different context, produced a completely different reaction in people. And I think that's, you know, that's a really valuable lesson for communicators for shaping their context, but also for the rest of us when we come to interpret how people are telling us things. You know, what is the context they're putting around their key message that might influence how we interpret their key message?
So what do you suggest we do when we're watching television and we're watching the news? How should we analyze it, you know, other than the advice of the presenters that this is a true fact as opposed to
a couple of quick things to suggest. First off, listen out for the things they're not saying. So what are they leaving out that might be relevant? What are the kind of interesting issues that they're not touching on, which maybe might reveal a different version of the truth? Are they, you know, particularly hitting and prioritizing certain elements of the story over other elements? Are they trying to, you know, we call it burying bad news? Are they trying to sort of skate over some of the less helpful, convenient elements of the story that they don't want to really talk about? Another thing to think about is, you know, how does it make you feel, this report, this news report, this story? Is it very evocative? Is it making you angry? Is it making you afraid? Because if it is, then there's a good chance that they're playing some kind of trick with, maybe it's the names they're using, maybe it's, you know, the associations they're drawing on. But have a look and see what is it that's making, you know, bringing out those emotions in you, and see whether that's clouding your judgment of the underlying facts that they're communicating and giving you a different slant on those facts. I think the final thing I'd suggest is look at the cause and effect that they're implying. When they tell you about, you know, two or three true events that have taken place, but imply a kind of causal link between them, so they're suggesting the first event caused the second event, ask yourself, is that really true? Have they provided evidence for that causation, or are they just telling you these events and, you know, leaving it up to you to assume there's a connection between them? So that's maybe four neat little tests you can put. There, of course, there are an awful lot more things in the book, in truth, that you can use to.
Well, it's full of very interesting stories. I like the thing about the F word, because I had never. I never understood what they were doing here. You know, when people have to read this book, because it's fascinating. And as I said, there's lots of very, you know, good examples of ways that we've been tricked to think of something in one way when it might have been the exact opposite. And we would also, you know, like to. I think you have to leave soon because you are in London. But I wanted to say, I want you back. Because I really like your books, and you know, I know that you are. I recognized your name when they sent me your book. They said Hector. Well, there aren't that many Hectors, and I had read Rogue Elements. And
you had. That's wonderful. And, how did you come across that?
Well, you know, this is funny how it happened. I bought a Rogue, and while I was on Amazon, I saw the name Rogue, and, well, I had to read a book named Rogue Elements.
Fantastic.
So I read it. It's wonderful.
You, thank you for giving some publicity to my last novel. I appreciate it.
I love Madeline Ray. I wanted to. I will arrange, and I want you to come back and talk about your thrillers, because you are a fantastic writer. And okay.
I'll happily do that, Patsy. Absolutely. My you can contact me directly through my website, hectormcdonald.com, or I'm sure Little Brown will be able to help put you in touch.
Okay, and we're gonna give you a whole lot of time here to talk about your wonderful books, okay? And meanwhile, everybody has to.
Thanks so much.
Okay, everybody has to get Hector McDonald Truth, How the Many Sides of Every Story Shape Our Reality. And I wanna thank you so much for being on today, Hector. Okay. Hector is gone because he's in England and we have to control that. Okay, that was nice. He's a great writer. His thrillers are, well, obviously, you know, he's highly educated. Let's put it that way. Yep. One of these British people I don't know. Well, of course, he went to Oxford and a couple other places, you know.
Yeah.
And so he as you said, he is a scientist. But then he started writing thrillers, and they are really exciting.
Oh, so, good. Another one to put on my to-be-read file.
Exactly. So I'm going to have him back on because...
Now, he seems well-balanced. That was nice.
He is. He's very well-balanced. Yeah, he's a nice guy. And this book... I love these stories because when you read them, like the Colgate thing or where they take somebody's statement and they cut off the first four words in it.
Yep.
So it's exactly the opposite of what the person said.
Yep.
And I love that he gives so many examples. And this book's available wherever books are sold on Amazon, and it's called Truth by Hector McDonald. You have to remember the name.
I'm going to look for it because I like knowing that stuff, like about Colgate. That's interesting.
It's
true, but it's... not the whole truth.
It's not the whole truth. Yeah. And so he has a whole... the book is filled with these examples.
I like
and it. It's really fascinating. And I think that everybody will enjoy it. And we've enjoyed having you here today. Carol J. Perry, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Taking over most of the show. I can just turn it over to you. You can handle it all.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you did a great job.
Anytime.
Okay. And I just want to say... everybody, my word for the year is Facebook. Please go to my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and like me, and I will like you. And follow me on Twitter, and I don't know, all of that stuff. Do you love to do Facebook?
Oh, yeah, but you're so techy. I don't know. I do have a Facebook
page.
Well,
my new webpage is beautiful, isn't it?
I know. I've seen it.
Very beautiful. Yeah. And you're on the front page today.
Am I?
Yeah. With your picture of you in Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble.
That's right. Standing right there with three of your books.
And I'm in the Wicked's newsletter today, too. That's a bunch of New England writers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So okay,
that's
so
great.
You're doing great. So you have to get back and have a look.
I will.
And everybody has to have a look at it. Because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. You have great audible books. Or maybe someday to see it on the screen, television, or movie. And I think we'll see that with Carol one day. And just have fun writing and just enjoy yourself and say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He managed to get all my sign up and get this call from London. And he saluted me. I salute him. And everybody have a wonderful, wonderful day. And I hope in a few days this sore throat goes away. Okay, bye-bye for now. Bye.